So on this retreat, brothers in the Dharma, we only have 10 days to look at Bhante's book, The Ten Pillars of Buddhism. And that's nowhere near enough time. Although it's a very short book, it's a highly concentrated work. It's very, very rich. Like I said last night, it is like a pot of Marmite. It's full of goodness. And it needs much unpacking and unfolding. There's all sorts of allusions in the text and references, as well as it having considerable depth. And we need to really work to understand some of the passages in the Ten Pillars. We need to really work to draw out the implications within it. You could make the Ten Pillars of Buddhism your sort of root text for the whole of your Dharma life. I think if, you know, one read that text and reread it and followed up all the different references to it and really, above all, reflected on it and turned it into a living experience, you probably wouldn't need anything else. You probably wouldn't need any other text, I would suspect. This morning I want to draw out some of the aspects of part one of the book, which is discussing the ten precepts collectively. And often people skip over part one. People can sometimes think it rather theoretical, even scholarly. They want to quickly get on to the practicalities of the actual precepts, which, you know, there is, of course, great importance in that. But it's a great mistake to really skip over this, the first section. And in a way, it would be better if we had a much longer retreat whereby we could really unpack the first section. It's a great mistake, even a grave mistake, I think, not to take the first section seriously. It's of considerable importance and we need to know it and understand it. Before part one, there's an introduction. The book was originally a paper that Bhante gave over 2 days on the 16th anniversary of the founding of the order. So in many ways, it's quite an intimate text because it's something that he gave to a gathering of his disciples. And in his introduction, Bhante has something to say about maturity, which is interesting in itself. The only point I want to make here, it was 16 years before Bhante gave a systematic exposition of the 10 precepts that he gave and we take at ordination. 16 years. I can't help feeling it was almost as if we were only really ready at that point to really take on the profundity of the precepts that he'd given us and we'd committed ourselves to. Of course, Bhante had talked about many of the areas covered in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism before. But this was really the first time he brings those things together in a systematic and an essential form. And I can remember at the time, the Ten Pillars of Buddhism had a really powerful effect on the order. It was a real injection, I think, of clarity and inspiration, as well as being a bit of a challenge. And it stood the test of time, I think, this text. It's still relevant. It will always be relevant. In his introduction, he makes very clear that ethics, that morality, our precepts are not some elementary Buddhist practice, and that they can be safely dispensed with while we contemplate the mysteries of Zen or the far out practices of Tantra. They're not an elementary Buddhist practice, the precepts, but their implications are profound and far reaching. And he refers to the paradoxical words of a poet, I think it might be Wordsworth, you must love them before they will seem to you worthy of your love. You must love the precepts before they will seem to you worthy of your love. That's something to reflect on in itself. And I wonder if perhaps Bhante had in mind the Buddhist tradition's emphasis on loving, cherishing, revering your training, your shiksha, your training, sikha, as in sikhapadam. This is one of the 5 garavas, traditionally, the 5 objects of reverence The others include the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the qualities that you're trying to develop in your Dharma life, as well as the whole spread and range of the Dharma for the benefit of all. But one of these is Shiksha. You revere the actual training that you've taken up. In other words, you look up to it, you respect it, it has weight for you, you cherish it, you love it. So I think that's a really interesting point, that Buddhist tradition, that the Buddha himself, this is an old Pali tradition, talks about actually revering and cherishing the very precepts that you follow, the very training that you follow. Perhaps something to reflect upon there. Milarepa, in his songs, often speaks of guarding your vows as if they were your own eyes. Guarding your vows as if they were your own eyes. Well, we care very much about our eyes, about our sight. They're extremely important to us. Well, in the same way, we need to care very, very deeply about the precepts that we take, the training that we follow. We need to love them, respect them, revere them. Because they're not simply rules. They're not simply rules, but profound spiritual principles that we're learning to live by for the benefit of all. We've got to really, really learn to appreciate the profound spiritual principles on which our precepts are based. So that's just some thoughts from the introduction. The beginning of part one is the relation between the refuges and precepts. Early on in this short section, he talks about this idea of the mandala, looking at our life, our personal life, as a mandala, and that in going for refuge, in committing ourselves to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we place, what we're doing is placing the Buddha at the centre of the mandala of our life. And everything is rearranged when we do that in terms of levels of importance in relation to the Buddha. Even some activities will have to be sort of banished from the mandala. They have no place in relation to the Buddha. I think it's a very important and interesting image, that of the mandala. We've just done a retreat on it here, actually, the Entering the Greater Mandala retreat. And one of the points that emerged in that was that the mandala principle, looking at the mandala of our life, isn't a sort of time management idea. This idea of reorganizing your life around the Buddha doesn't mean, well, I'll give a little bit of time to Buddhism, I'll give a little bit of time to my, I'll give lots of time to my job, etc., etc. It's not a time management idea. The mandala principle is profoundly monarchical. It comes from the ancient Indian traditions of rulership, of kingship, of royalty. The mandala idea is that the Buddha is actually raised up within the centre of our life. And the influence is all-pervading on all areas of our life. It's profoundly hierarchical. So the reorganisation that Sangharakshita is talking about when you place the Buddha at the centre is much more of a transformation of our life. So that's a very important point to reflect on. He goes on to speak of the precepts as being the direct expression of the spiritual and existential act of going for refuge. By existential, he's not talking about existentialist philosophy. He means existential in the sense of to do with our very being, our very existence. It's as vital and as fundamental as that. So the precepts are the direct expression of the spiritual and existential act of going for refuge. Immediately after you go for refuge in the ordination ceremony, and it's reflected in our puja and so on, you take the precepts. So the precepts are the immediate expression of the going for refuge. There's an immediate abstaining from certain things, a turning away from certain actions of states of mind, and a commitment to acting differently, acting positively. He uses the analogy with going for refuge in the precepts that it's like the relationship between the seed and the flower. If going for refuge is the seed, then the precepts are the flowering of the seed. And later, as I've already quoted, a particularly powerful metaphor of blood. Going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is one's life blood as a Buddhist, as a Dharmachari, as a Dharmacharini. Practicing the 10 precepts is the circulation of that blood. If blood doesn't circulate, it ceases to be blood and the organism dies. They're very, very strong words indeed, and I think need to be meditated upon frequently. Sometimes we can feel stuck, we can feel dry in our practice, things don't flow. We don't feel that our life, our spiritual life, our Dharma life, our life generally is really alive. And we can often look for solutions. Well, we do look for solutions. And often the last place we actually look is our ethics. That can often be the last place to go to really make us feel alive, dharmically or with our life. It's usually entertainment that we turn to, or some sort of technique. Maybe we're not being that unskillful. But what about the positive? How kind are we? How generous are we? What about wisdom? How much are we really trying to develop true Buddhist wisdom and so on in our day-to-day life? So we need to perhaps think a bit more about that. But if we're feeling dry, look at the precepts. How is the blood of our going for refuge really circulating? Is it circulating? Bhante in this connection speaks of the practice of the precepts as the prolongation of the act of going for refuge into every aspect of our life. That's the way the lifeblood of the Buddhist life circulates, through the prolongation of going for refuge into every aspect of life. I looked up prolongation in the Shorter Oxford, and it means extending in time, as in to prolong. But it can also mean extend in scope and range. So the prolonging isn't just a temporal thing, it's also the quality of the prolonging that's being referred to, of the going for refuge. So we can always improve our practice of the precepts. In the second section of part one, he goes to the canonical sources of the 10 precepts that we take. Because he'd noticed that some Buddhists had said, well, are these really traditional? How much they've studied, people who say that, is another matter. I remember in India, when we first started our order there, people hadn't heard of the 10 precepts that we take at ordination, so we often got questions about the pedigree of our 10 precepts. But Bhante shows the places in the Pali text and in the Sanskrit texts where our 10 precepts occur. It's clearly a very ancient set of precepts. And what's very striking, so in some of the passages quoted, the Buddha teaches the 10 precepts to both monks, bhikshus, and upasakas, householders, so-called lay people. He teaches them to both. They're both of equal importance to both the full-timers and, as it were, the part-timers. That's not the right kind of language. But yes, the monks and the laymen. So very important, and it relates a bit to this business of commitment, primary and lifestyle secondary, which comes up later. One of my favourite things that he quotes is from a Mahayana text, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. One of these is that the practice of the 10 precepts is the way in which bodhisattvas purify their Buddha field. The practice of the 10 precepts is the way in which bodhisattvas create a pure land. They're very, very inspiring, bringing out the altruistic dimension of the 10 precepts. And Vimalakirti also talks about the 10 precepts being one of the ways in which one gives birth to the Tathagata Kaya, the body of the Tathagata. In his first discourse in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, Vimalakirti talks about how this body of flesh and blood is not a refuge. It's not reliable. It will break down. And one should focus one's attention instead on the Tathagata Kaya, on the body of the Buddha, which is born out of many qualities, including the practice of the Ten Precepts. So you can also look at the Ten Precepts as a spiritual rebirth practice. Through practicing these Ten Precepts, a new being will emerge. But the main point that Bhante is making in various ways is that we're following a very ancient and venerable tradition through practicing these precepts. Thirdly, there's a section on the Ten Precepts and total transformation. He goes through the different analyses of the human personality and body speech in Buddhist tradition, you know, so nama, rupa, the skandhas, body speech and mind. Again, this is one of those sections where you could make a lifetime study of just a page of text. And he points out, Bhante, that the Ten Precepts cover body, speech and mind. There are mind precepts to follow. So it's a very, very thorough set. And in following these precepts, we're talking about the total transformation of our being. Then he moves on to, in the fourth section, the Ten Precepts as principles of ethics. And here Bhante explores one of the traditional ways in which the Ten Precepts are described. This is important, this phrase, Ten Precepts. There are a number of different terms for what we call the Ten Precepts in the Buddhist tradition. And this is particularly exploring the Dasa Kusala Dhamma. Part of the or appellation of the Ten Precepts, the ten ways of skillful action. There's a very interesting discussion here of the word kusala, skillful, by the way, which I'd recommend that you look up. It's extremely thorough. I mean, we usually when we talk about skillfulness, we talk about states of mind free from greed, hatred, delusion. Made up of, you know, contentment, or generosity, loving kindness, and clarity. But Bhante's definition of skillful following the tradition is extremely thorough. But I think at one part of it, he says that skillful action is mindful, constantly aware of the three lakshanas. I don't think we often say that in our discussions of skillfulness. Constantly aware of the three lakshanas. So, that's something to look up. But the basic point in this section here is that the Ten Precepts are not essentially rules, to quote Bhante, in the narrow, pettifogging sense of the term. I looked up pettifogging. It's quite an old-fashioned word. It means narrow, quibbling, and legalistic. These are not what the Ten Precepts are. They are not narrow rules in the pettifogging sense of the term. You sometimes get into that in discussions of ethics where there's a sort of quibbling going on what constitutes observing the precept and what doesn't. It can often be very distracting. Often people getting into Buddhism will ask you, if you've been in Buddhism for a while, are you allowed to do this? Can you do that? And so on. They want to know the rules. They even expect you to follow rules. But if you are a serious Buddhist, deeply connected with the Dharma, you're not thinking in terms of rules. You live instead by deep spiritual and ethical principles and ideals. Perhaps this moral sense that Maitreya Bandhu talked about. You strive and live up to those principles and ideals. You're not thinking in terms of getting away with something, for example. You sometimes get this a bit. I sometimes get asked, you know, is it okay if I do this and can I still be ordained? As if you can sort of get by this through not doing something, which doesn't really seem to be quite the spirit of it, really. Let's just take the first precept. It's not enough for us to abstain from harming living beings. It's not enough to be vegetarian and even vegan and other things like that, although those things are very important. You want to do much, much more if you're going to observe this precept. You want to learn to love, although, as Maitreya Bandhu says, and Bhante says in his discussion of the first precept, love is far too weak a word for what is really being described here. You don't just want to avoid certain things. You want to learn to love. You want to understand what the principle of loving kindness really is, and how profound it is. And you want to love deeply and widely and wisely. And yes, this is definitely reflected in Bhante's exposition of the 10 precepts. He's keen to evoke, first and foremost, in each discussion of the precept, the deep ethical principle involved, and then point to some of the implications of that principle. Of course, the implications are sort of endless, but at first, he wants us to really get the principle of the thing. At the same time, we must be careful not to let ourselves off the hook. I have heard people rationalise their craving for meat and fish in terms of, well, it's the spirit of the precept that's important. Chomp, chomp, chomp. If you're really living by ethical ideals, that will find expression in the details, the minute details, the minute particulars, as William Blake calls them, of your life, in your actual deeds. There's a saying of Padmasambhava, a very important teaching, that goes, we need to descend with the vision and ascend with the conduct. So when we look at the precepts, live by the precepts, we need to be aware of the profound spiritual principle that they embody. We need to have the vision of the precept. But that awareness needs to descend into our daily life, into the minutiae of our life. And at the same time, our conduct, our day-to-day behaviour, needs to always be ascending in the direction of our ideals and vision. There's another famous saying of Padmasambhava, my vision is as vast as space. My attention to action and its effects is as fine as flour. Put another way, we need both vision and transformation when we look at the precepts. Then the fifth section is the 10 precepts as rules of training. In that last section, Bhante pointed out that although the 10 precepts are profound spiritual principles, spiritual ideals, rules can be derived from them. So this section looks at this. But again, don't take that word rule in the wrong kind of way. What he explores here is the precepts as shikshapada, sikhapada, as in the precepts that we chant in the puja, sikhapadam. It's the same word in Pali as shikshapada in Sanskrit. So this is the term that's used when we actually chant the precepts in Pali. Perhaps the English, the positive counterparts of these precepts, Bhante didn't used to call them the positive precepts, he used to call them the spirit of the precepts. But yes, the positive counterparts are expressing the 10 precepts as the great ethical principles, perhaps, of the last section. But let's stay with Sikhapada, Shikshapada. So Sikhapada can be translated as item of training. Pada, item, Sikha, training. So Sikha being the word for training. But Bhante points out that the word Shiksha in Sanskrit, Sikha in Pali, means learning, training, and comes from a verbal root meaning to be able, to be able. So when one takes the precepts from a teacher, a preceptor, at the time of ordination, it means that you are capable of learning those great ethical principles and capable of training in them. The preceptor is confident that you are able and capable of training in those precepts. This is an incredibly important point, actually. It might seem a very obvious point, but let's not take it for granted. Here you all are, training for ordination, learning what ordination really means, learning about it from teachers, from preceptors, from Kalyanamitras, from order members. Part of that training for ordination is becoming capable of training in those 10 great ethical principles. Maybe you feel that you're already able to do that. But what does it mean to be capable, to be able? Perhaps this is a whole discussion in itself, but perhaps what it means essentially, it just boils down to, in a sense, one thing. Being able to take individual, personal responsibility for your actions. In other words, recognizing the law of karma, the karma niyama. Living by the law of karma. Being able to take individual, personal responsibility for your actions, for your ethics. It's reflected, of course, in those first two verses of the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. And by mind here, the Buddha isn't being metaphysical. He means our mind, the mind that we have. That's very important to make that point. The text actually goes on. It's very interesting where the Dhammapada goes next, because what you get next is this. Those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. Not by hatreds are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Others do not realize that we are all heading for death. Those who do realize it will compose their quarrels. It's very, very interesting, I find, still fascinating, that where the Buddha goes after the verses on mind is to the whole topic of blame. You know when someone is really taking the Dharma seriously when they've stopped blaming others for their dukkha. That's when you know whether or not somebody's seriously, when they are completely committed to loving kindness and they've stopped blaming others, whatever's gone on in their life. They are living an independent, as it were, a less conditioned ethical life. They are taking personal responsibility for their actions. They really have taken on seriously the law of karma and not some other form of explanation for their difficulties, if you like. They see that happiness, meaning and satisfaction is realized through their actions of body, speech and mind, through practicing the precepts. It's interesting that word which is translated as pure in Sangharakshita's translation, he who acts with a pure mind or an impure mind. The word the word for impure is more like spoilt, a spoilt mind. You've tainted it. It's implying that actually there is something positive there. And the word translated as pure is a word related to pasada, which can mean pure. It can also mean clear, but it's one of the words for faith. One of the words for faith. So these first two verses are implying that we've been touched by something, as it were, transcendent. There's a reflection of reality that's enabling us to take seriously these first two verses and to take seriously the law of karma. Sometimes I talk to people who want to be ordained, very much want to be ordained, but there's so much blame still in their lives, so much sort of resentment. And going with that, a kind of new forms of righteous indignation. It might not be a kind of Christian forms, but there are modern forms of righteous indignation. And very much an over-concern with other people's ethics and not their own behaviour. They're even very keen to point out the ethical failings, especially of order members. How long have you got? So much so, I wonder why they even want to be ordained. It's almost as if it seems they're relating to it as a sort of promotion, almost like a sort of power structure or something like that. And of course, they're seriously missing the point. It can even happen even after ordination. Sadly, within the order itself, people can slip into these attitudes, which is really not, really missing the point of these 10 precepts of ethics. Very interesting, Asanga, in his work on the Bodhisattva precepts. It's very complicated work, the Bodhisattva precepts, but the first chapter on the essence of ethics, the essence of the whole matter, is in a sense very simple. And he says, if you really want to practice the precepts, you need, the first thing you need is a pure motive. Suvishuddhashaya in Sanskrit. You need a really pure motive. Because if you have a pure motive, when you fail in your training, it's assuming you can have a pure motive and still fail, it seems. But if you have a pure motive, you really are doing it because you want to gain enlightenment for all beings. If you have that pure motive, when you fail in your training, what will arise is hri, shame, which isn't irrational guilt. It's this intense shame, regret at what you've done, or what you are about to do, or what you did in the past. Very, very interesting area. And it makes it clear that, and perhaps this is what Maitreya Bandhu is getting at as well, that the essence of ethics is a sensibility. It's a sensibility that we're trying to develop. It's related, I think, even to an aesthetic sensibility. You know, when somebody does something really well, we don't say, oh, what a good moral action. You say, that is beautiful. That behaviour is so beautiful. There's something right about it. It's deeply pleasing. And similarly, when we look at our own behaviour, I can use the word immoral, but actually more powerful and more accurate. This is ugly. This is really ugly, ignoble, mean of me, to be like this. It's much more sort of aesthetic language. So this quality of hri is really important to generate. And we need to sort it out from, guilt, irrational guilt, authority issues, all that sort of thing. It's something much, much deeper. Lama Govinda points out, the great Lama Govinda Panthi's friend, that the word hri comes from a root to blush. And it's the same word as Amitabha's seed syllable. So when we're chanting Om Amideva Hri, invoking the red Buddha, we're actually sort of invoking that deep ethical sensibility. We might even find ourselves burning with a bit of shame. And he makes the point, Lama Govinda, that those moments of shame are actually the rising up of our Buddha potential. It's actually moments of shame that are really the rising up of the profoundest in us. So a wonderful insight of his. Now in this section, Bhante makes clear that training implies a trainee, and precepts imply a preceptor, a trainee and a preceptor, if you like. Indeed, in the previous section on the principles of ethics, Bhante actually uses the language of disciple, that the precepts are transmitted at ordination by teacher to disciple. That's the word he uses. Some years ago, Bhante did an interview which was sent out as a sort of message to all order members. At that time it was called What is the Western Buddhist Order, because we were still the Western Buddhist Order. And Bhante uses the term disciple to describe the order. He defined the order as the community of his disciples and the disciples of his disciples. And the use of this term disciple that Bhante's used here has stirred things up a little within the order and even outside of the order. There's been all sorts of responses to it, and they still kind of go on a bit. Perhaps we're still in the process of unpacking the meaning of this term. When we were having a question and answer session on it, I asked Bhante if the word disciple corresponded to the Pali sekho, and he said that's what he had in mind. So sekho means someone in training. And disciple really means much the same thing, someone who is learning. But with the word disciple, there's definitely a connotation of something, as it were, religious, spiritual, and even formal. But being a disciple means, essentially, that you are capable of following a training, and you are committed to that training, a specific training. In the Triratna, the specific ethical training is in the 10 precepts, as taught and as transmitted by Sangharakshita and his disciples. So in training for ordination, you're learning about the precepts, the 10 precepts, in theory and practice, in the letter, and very importantly, in the spirit, from Sangharakshita and his disciples. And if you know, getting involved with this, you're seeing yourself as part of this stream of tradition. And at the time of ordination, of course, you formally take the precepts, the 10 precepts, from your preceptor. In the private ordination, you take them from your private preceptor. After he witnesses your going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, he gives you and you take the 10 precepts from him, in Pali form and then in their positive form in English. So obviously, the relationship with your private preceptor is incredibly important. And you need to take great care in choosing someone, approaching someone, to be your private preceptor. A preceptor is not, as it were, your mate, essentially, although you might have something of a matey connection with them. They're not a pal, essentially. But there's someone who you respect, who's going for refuge and practice of the precepts inspires you, impresses you. They might not, you know very well, they're not perfect in the practice of the precepts, but you can see they're really having a go and you can look up to that. There's someone you can trust. There's someone who's available to you, who you have a warm connection with. You can talk to them easily. There's something of a friendship, even a strong friendship to you, of Kalyanamitrita. But there's respect as well. They, as it were, hold your training. They hold the ideal for you, the ethical ideal for you, but in a very, very positive way. They're not a policeman chasing you up. That's definitely not what a preceptor or Kalyanamitra does, always kind of on your case, nagging at you to, you know, improve your practice of the precepts. That shouldn't really be like that at all. You naturally refer to them. You want to. Sometimes your preceptor or your spiritual friend will be the holder of your conscience. At least that's the way you think of them in that way. They're not self-consciously, or I've got to be the holder of their conscience. That's not the way you feel as a preceptor or as a Kalyanamitra. But you feel that. You know, because they witnessed your going for refuge, that incredible moment when you committed to the Dharma. Referring to a Sangha again, he said, yes, you need a pure motive, which will lead to Hri. But he says, you also need something else. You need to have respect for your preceptor. Actually, he uses much stronger language. He uses the word revere again. You need to revere your preceptor. This is a much more hierarchical tradition that a Sangha is coming from, which we're not quite like that in our own order. But what a Sangha says, because you respect your preceptor, when you fail in your training, apatrapya arises. Apatrapya. Apatrapya literally means to turn away. It means to turn away in the sense out of shame. You turn away from unskillfulness because you bring to mind your spiritual friend, naturally, as it were. Perhaps a rendering of it goes something like this. It's sensitivity to the opinion of spiritual friends. shame in relation to spiritual friends. So if you don't meditate, or you don't feel like meditating, or you've gone through a tricky period, you're feeling very lazy, you think, well, what would my preceptor say if I had to tell him about this? How would he feel about that? He'd be concerned for me, for example. Obviously, this means for a preceptor, there is tremendous responsibility. And within the order we take the whole business of becoming a preceptor very seriously. The preceptor has to be an order member of at least 10 years standing and in good standing within the order. And there's a whole training for them and consultation process about becoming a preceptor. So that's quite a thing our end. So I wanted to just go into that. Bounty doesn't talk about preceptors and so on. But, it's unpacking this idea. You take the precepts from someone. So that means the relationship is going to be very important. Bounty makes many more points in this section, by the way, about the 10 precepts, what it means to train in the 10 precepts. And years ago, I followed this up with a little booklet called Training in the Precepts. I just followed up some of the list of things that you mentioned. You might want to refer to that. Just want to say a bit more about the private preceptor. Your private preceptor isn't your guru, and it's not an exclusive relationship. This is very important. The private preceptor is part of a whole network and range of spiritual friends. Yes, his particular responsibility, and joyous responsibility, is that he witnesses your individual commitment to the three jewels. He witnesses your capability of training in the precepts. But there's also the public preceptor. The public preceptor receives you into the order. He gives you the precepts publicly. In a sense, the public preceptor stands for the order, for he's there as well. The public preceptor will kind of preside over your training. He'll put the stamp on it, the seal on it. But your relationship with him will probably be a bit more distant. Nearer to you will be your two Kalyana Mitras, two spiritual friends. There is also your peers, your chapter, and so on. All of these people are incredibly important in training in the precepts. All these dimensions of spiritual community, spiritual friendship. It's very interesting looking at ordination traditions at the time of the Buddha, as far as we know them. I think particularly of late on in the Buddha's life, just before his parinirvana, Subhadra comes to him. He's a wanderer in another tradition. He wants to meet the Buddha, has a very powerful communication with him, and becomes a stream entrant, and then goes for refuge and asks to be ordained. It's interesting. It's after stream entry that he wants ordination. And the Buddha, I think, simply says, "Ehi bhikkhave, come." Just names him as a bhikkhu. But the commentary on this says that after that, other monks, other bhikkhus, took him off to shave his head, to give him his robe, to give him his particular meditation instruction, and so on. So the point is that there's not only the Buddha, but all these other bhikkhus are playing their part in the ordination of Subhadra. In other words, he's practicing within an ethical community. His training is shared by a whole community. It's not what's been described by an American Buddhist as smother, the single monolithic vertical relationship, which described the sort of guru-disciple relationship in America at that time. We don't do smother. I don't know our little thing is. There's too many people involved. Yes. So where are I? Certainly one thing I hope is very, very clear from this. The precepts are learned through living and practicing with spiritual friends. The precepts, after all, are broad and general. Life is specific and complex. And the right action isn't always clear. The skillful action isn't always clear. The application of the principle isn't always clear, or the principle is hard to see within the given situation. spiritual friends can help us clarify things. And they're also an example for us. As Longchenpa says, a great Nyingmapa Lama, by living with worthy friends, you yourself become worthy, like the creeper taking on the scent of the sandalwood tree. Living together, working together for the Dharma, you learn so, so much about ethics through living and working with spiritual friends, about actually living it, actually doing it. Obviously, not everyone can live with preceptors and spiritual friends and so on. That's quite rare. But really make the most of being with people you regard as spiritual friends. There's so much you just learn in the day-to-day. I remember an older member who lived here for many years, who left. He said to me after he left, he said he learned so much, you know, from being around the older members here, the senior older members here, well, and the less experienced, just so much in the day-to-day interactions, the day-to-day discussions about different issues, work issues, planning things, so much about ethics. He even says to me now where he works, when he's approaching a dilemma, what would so-and-so think? What would so-and-so do? And he means an older member. How would Ratnagosha do this, for example? Very interesting. So, moving on, the 10 precepts as mula pratimoksha. The 10 precepts as the fundamental pratimoksha, the fundamental code of ethics. You might not realise this, but this section is actually revolutionary. Most people probably won't get that, but it's actually a serious challenge to Buddhist orthodoxy. But the challenge takes its stand on deeply orthodox principles. You could even say it's an orthodoxy to outdo, received orthodoxy. Really extraordinary bit of work. And you could say that it's, that its implications mean that being in the Triratna Buddhist order is both radical in the sense of going to the root of things and revolutionary in the sense of bringing about a very great change in the Buddhist world. Makes it clear that it's going to the root, but the Triratna is also something new. But the newness is based on something very deeply traditional. So let's look at this term mula pratimoksha, the fundamental or root basis for liberation. Bhante points out in this section the term patimokkha in Pali, pratimoksha in Sanskrit. Its origins are very obscure and people are still working out what it really means. Some scholars believe that the original pratimoksha were simply kind of essential verses that were recited by the different wandering groups at their 2 weekly chapter meetings. When they'd get together, they'd kind of rehearse the essence of their training. So some people believe, for example, a few verses in the Dhammapada, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the heart. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. That and 2 or 3 verses that followed was the original pratimoksha of the Buddhist community. But later on, the pratimoksha develops in a very complicated way. But I like this idea of as a tradition, you have this sort of fundamental code that you follow. In the Padmaloka chapter, we have our chapter meeting where we meet. We chant the refuges and precepts and sit in silence. And it's like recommitting yourself to your fundamental code of training. And I feel that we're kind of following an old tradition that the monks did long ago, the wanderers did long ago. But over time, the term pratimoksha, just to go back to that, it was a term used for the particular ethical code or the particular set of precepts that go with the traditionally recognized forms of ordination that developed over the centuries in the Buddhist tradition. Bhante mentions the 7 kinds of pratimoksha. There's a traditional set of 7 different ordinations. The thing is, the 10 precepts that we follow are not one of those pattern watches. The 10 precepts, as far as we know, are not now associated with a particular kind of ordination in the Buddhist tradition, except for us. Even though these 10 precepts are mentioned all over the Buddhist world, where they're probably most prominent now is in relation to the Bodhisattva path, which is perhaps significant in Tibet and certainly East Asia. I think there are some East Asian schools that do have the 10 precepts as their Bodhisattva vows. It's very interesting. What Bhante has done has been to place going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha at the heart of ordination. He's saying that that is what is essential and central, regardless of whether one is a monk or a nun or a householder. He doesn't like this word lay person, by the way. He says no order member should call themselves a layman. It implies something part-time. Householder, yes. Layman, no. So again, very important. Get that. So going for refuge is the primary thing. The commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Whatever your particular status. Another place, Bhante says, all the members have a statusless status. Perfection of wisdom. And going with the going for refuge is this essential, fundamental ethical code that expresses that going for refuge in these 10 precepts. Because, he says, these 10 precepts, out of all the sets of precepts in the Buddhist tradition, really embody the great ethical ideals. And they cover not just the body and speech, but mind as well, even the very depths of the mind. They're the most thoroughgoing in that sense. In saying this, Bhante's not being sectarian. This is quite important. He's identifying what is essential to Buddhist life. He's even expressing through this his conviction that going for refuge to the three jewels and observing the 10 precepts is a way of unifying all Buddhists. He even quotes from a sutta in the Pali Canon, where the 10 precepts are really expressed as the norm of behaviour, of all, or not just all human behaviour, but all sentient life. It's quite a remarkable passage. Let me just draw your attention to it. On page 44, 45. And Sariputta, if all nobles, all Brahmins, all merchants, all workers could thus understand the meaning in full of this that was spoken by me in brief for a long time, he's talked about the 10 precepts, it would be for their welfare and happiness. And Sariputta, if the world with the Devas, with the Maras and the Brahmas, and if the generations of wanderers and Brahmins, Devas and men could thus understand the meaning in full of this that was spoken of by me in brief, for a long time it would be for their welfare and happiness. So Bhante's comment, this would suggest that the 10 precepts represent the norm of ethical behaviour, not only for all Buddhists, but for all human beings, indeed for all forms of self-conscious, sentient existence. Which is a very powerful statement. And again, you can see that we're not dealing with something cultural, we're not dealing with rules, we're dealing with natural morality, a morality based on the law of karma, perhaps the morality based on dhammata, the dharma niyama, the way things are. But let's move on quickly. Then seventhly, there's the 10 precepts and other ethical formulae. This section makes it clear that the 10 precepts go beyond simply ethics in the narrow sense. He shows how each of the precepts can be distributed over the three great trainings of morality, meditation and wisdom, as taught by the Buddha. And as such, the 10 precepts are the basis for liberation. He said it might be quite good if somebody did a chart of this. So finally, the 10 precepts and lifestyle. Here he comments on the famous phrase, commitment is primary, lifestyle is secondary, and here he's concerned to correct a misunderstanding, especially any notion that someone can rationalise away unskillful action with the phrase, well, that's my lifestyle. He makes it clear, again, that going for refuge will be expressed in our following of the precepts. The precepts are not a lifestyle choice. They are the expression of the precepts. So I don't think there's any need to say more, except perhaps that there's no end to following the precepts. If we're serious about going for refuge, we'll be continually searching for ways to improve our ethics, our actions of body, speech and mind, to prolong the spiritual and existential act of going for refuge. In studying the 10 pillars, we'll be challenged very much to do this, challenged to look at ourselves. Mantra Bandhu talked about being naked to the precepts last night. We might feel sobered in looking at this, even ashamed at times, but I think it also will be inspired and uplifted. I think actually the two often go together. When you're really inspired and uplifted, when your faith is really aroused, not far away is that feeling of sometimes of shame and challenge. Whatever, let's engage fully with Bhante. He's our preceptor for this retreat. And let's see what we can do to really make the lifeblood of the going for refuge to really flow.